offers to carry business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Valentine versus the City of Chicago. Mr. Stein.
Judge Flom, Judge Evans, Judge Williams, counsel for the defendants. May it please the court, I have the honor today of arguing Valentine versus the City of Chicago before this court this morning, along with my co-counsel Cecile Singer and my invaluable clerks Ben Netsky and Aaron Goodman. We put together this appeal. A few short years ago, plaintiff was a hard-working truck driver with the city's Department of Transportation. She became a truck driver as a mother had been, not to break new ground or make a political statement. She liked hard physical work and needed to put food on her table. That all changed in 2002 when a low-life serial sexual harasser who had clout was transferred to the Bosworth Yard with the help and approval of a family friend named Joe Sinise and the approval of the Sexual Harassment Office of the City of Chicago. Prior to Tominello's transfer, things were okay at Bosworth. Plaintiff tolerated much of the vulgar language, bad jokes, many sexist, etc. After all, truck driving and construction were a male-dominated industry, and within the City of Chicago, patronage often led to a job in the first place. Plaintiff's hard work was rewarded by the lot supervisor, Mike D'Atusa, when he made her his E-man. Mike had been a supervisor for many years. He referred to himself as a supervisor. He parked in the lot supervisor's lot. He appointed the E-man. He gave work assignments. He assigned trucks. He made sure that the trucks were in repair. He guarded over the Bosworth Yard, which was not open to the public, but fenced in and protected by security guards. He dealt with everything a supervisor dealt with in the City of Chicago. In fact, supervisor was not apparently a title in the Department of Transportation, but he was the lot supervisor and had been for many, many years. His buddy, Joe Sinise, was the acting general foreman. Joe and Mike talked to each other, as foreman and supervisor would, about many things.
Is Sinise the person that would ordinarily act on complaints like this?
No.
Why not?
Because the sexual harassment policy of the City of Chicago says there are four places a plaintiff or a complainant can go. The first place, number one on the list, is a supervisor in the complainant's department. It doesn't say the supervisor. It doesn't say the commissioner. It doesn't say under guidelines or definitions of Title VII. It says a supervisor. The City of Chicago put Mike D'Atusa in the position of supervisor, and he did the job as supervisor. Now, the second place she could have gone was the Department of Affirmative Action, the EEO officer. She chose not to do that. She went to Mike D'Atusa, her supervisor, a person that she had been working for 8 or 9 years. Guy has an air-conditioned office, has an office in the lot trailer, has a desk, has a phone, and that's where he stayed all day, especially in the summer heat where his office was air-conditioned. Everybody went to him as a supervisor. Everybody went to him about complaints. In fact, when D'Atusa had allegedly a problem with my client's apparel, and he thought that she was wearing clothing that was inappropriate for the job, he went to Joe Sinise. Just as he went to Joe Sinise when the plaintiff complained to him about Tominello's behavior at least 10 times. Why does it come out that they complained they had a problem with my client's clothing? Why? Because they had her complaints about Tominello, who had been transferred to this lot because he was under investigation for sexual harassment while under the supervision of Joe Sinise, where he didn't report the claims of Elizabeth Farrell, where he didn't report what he observed about how Tominello behaved with Colleen Julian.
Now D'Atusa didn't have the ability to fire or hire or transfer any employees, did he?
He had the power to transfer, but not to fire and hire. Neither did Sinise have the power to hire and fire. And that gets perhaps to the heart of the issue. In Parkins, this court's decision in Parkins says that when you have supervisor harassment, not co-worker harassment, and we're not making an allegation that DeTusa harassed Donna. It's Tominello that harassed Donna. One of the things that's different about this case that's with respect to all the other previous cases before this court is that Tominello was transferred because of allegations of sexual harassment, the most serious being the one where he put real deer testicles on a plate and rubbed them in Donna Farrell's face on the job in a trailer down on 39th Street. Not only did he do that, but he snapped her brassiere, broke her brassiere. Also, physical touching, rubbing deer testicles, and talked about Colleen Julian's body parts in front of Sinise. Everybody laughed about it. The context, the social and climate and the social context of these yards is that it's a male-dominated construction truck driver industry. Special concern should have been made and taken by the SHO when you have minorities, women, in a traditional male, whether it was male or white or whatever, employment. They should have taken more care in transferring something. They should have suspended him with pay. They could have sent him to a desk job. They could have put him in a yard without women.
Was the suspension after this incident, the September 25th reporting to Sinise, was that discipline appropriate in your view?
No, because while the investigation, this is a serial sexual harassment. This is a guy who'd been fired by the city, as the record reflects, years earlier and got reinstated. Now, it wasn't a sexual harassment issue. It was disrespect to a superior, to a supervisor. Again, we're not talking about the response by the SHO should have been, they should have alerted Sinise. Well, he knew already that why. In fact, he approved the transfer. So the city gets no protection by saying, well, she should have complained to Sinise. Tom DeTusa complained to Sinise. The inference is clear that the two of them talked. Now, Sinise, by the way, was family friends with Tominello's father. They belonged to the Italian-American Club in Bridgeport. They belonged to the 11th Ward Organization. There was all this, along this backdrop, you know, patronage trumps discrimination. That's the message here. And I don't think this court or any court should tolerate that.
Getting to the city's position and what happened when he was ultimately suspended, I mean, the fact that he was, you know, transferred and ultimately suspended, doesn't that suggest there was not a widespread practice of ignoring harassment complaints?
No, because there are other incidents where in Department of Sanitation, in the Department of Water, in other departments, there is harassment goes on in male-dominated, traditional male jobs, harassment of women, and people do not get they might get an oral reprimand. They might get a two-day suspension. He should have been fired. He should not have even been working at the Bosworth Yard. He should have been suspended with pay. Even if you have a concern for his property rights, fine. Give him the money. Suspend him with pay so he doesn't do this again. Monitor him. Have somebody from the SHO make visits on some random basis. Make sure that Sinise makes visits to the... They didn't care. They didn't care what Tominello did, and they didn't care what harassing activities he engaged in. This is an afterthought. After all this is over, they make the suspension. And as far as I know, Tominello is still working with the city of Chicago. A victim of a dog bite has more rights than a plaintiff in a sexual harassment case against the city of Chicago. Maybe you're allowed one bite, but you don't get that second bite. And 29-day suspension, which comes way after the fact, is not enough. No. The sexual harassment policy is vague. It doesn't adequately inform the employees who to complain to. She complained to, I'm sorry.
You point to a couple of, a lot of different statements that were made. What are the two that you would say are the most egregious comments that were made to her?
To my client?
Yeah.
Well, I think that we refer to many things that were said,
but
there were six incidents of touching, of caressing her shoulders. That's also different than other cases.
There's no evidence of sexual touching here, is there?
No, well, I think touching her shoulders in the way that plaintiff described had a sexual connotation. I think the cookie incident is very, very, is also not even verbal. It's touching. I also think the incident where he says, I'm going to go to Chinatown to get my pipes clean, and grabs his crotch. I think that's very, very, I think reference to her breasts and her buttocks, the way she looked, all those things. Every case in this court that has dealt with sexual harassment and hostile work environment refers to those kind of references. Now, for instance, take Whitaker, which the court decided against the plaintiff. The remarks made by the person involved were made after she left, and she didn't even know about them until she filed the suit. I want to make clear, though, we're not talking about supervisor harassment. We're talking about coworker harassment. And to impose what is, a manufactured definition in a coworker harassment case that she had to complain to somebody who hired and fired her is exactly what Judge Rovner said was a problem with Parkins in her concurring opinion in Higbee. We have potential unintended consequences. And I ask this court to take a look at Mack versus Otis, the Second Circuit case, and to take a look at Loftman, decided by this court. I think Judge Evans wrote the opinion. Loftman says it's a jury question as to whether or not the plaintiff reasonably could conclude that this complaint that she made was to a supervisor. I see my white light is on. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. Ms. Masters.
May it please the Court. Valentine has devoted much of her brief and just now much of her argument to the issue of whether Mike DeTusso was a supervisor whose knowledge of harassment put the city on notice for purposes of Title VII. But this case can be resolved without even getting into that issue, because even if DeTusso was a supervisor and was the appropriate person to receive a complaint of sexual harassment, Valentine has not established that her complaints were enough to put the city on notice of sexual harassment. In fact, she has not even responded to that issue in her reply brief, which was one of our defenses we raised and one of our grounds for affirmance we raised in our response brief.
But didn't the city's harassment policy indicate that employees could complain to a department supervisor? I don't understand why this DeTusso was not a department supervisor.
Well, the issue, though, is that even if he was a supervisor, coming to him and saying that she felt aggravated, Valentine goes to him and says that Tominello aggravated her, was rude to her. Such complaints are just too generalized to be construed as communicating to DeTusso that Valentine felt sexually harassed. She also ultimately complains that he, quote, put his hands on her, but this turns out to be touching to her arms and shoulders that lasted a matter of seconds. And she doesn't even testify that she provided any details to him about the physical contact. Even if she had, touchings to these conventionally unsexual body parts are not enough.
So your position is from March to September 2002, she complained to him. I mean, you agree that she complained 10 times over those 4 months, but you would say that none of those complaints were of sexual harassment?
That is correct. Although, just to be clear, what's happened in this case is she says she complained 10 times to DeTusso. DeTusso actually denied that, so there's no testimony on his end as to what was said to him. So we're going, for purposes of summary judgment, by her own words, which are she goes to him and says, Tominello aggravated her, was rude to her, and then this put his hands on her. But she doesn't even go and tell him what body part. She doesn't describe it as creepy or sexual in nature. And as this court just noted, counsel describes it as caressing, but there's no evidence in the record that she ever goes to him and even says that. It's just he put his hands on me, and it turns out to be his shoulders. And the problem with that is that in the context of the Bosworth want, Valentine herself testifies that she even puts her hands and had put her hands on other coworkers' arms and shoulders. This case, in this regard, this case is very much like the case that was just decided last month that we cite as supplemental authority, Velez versus City, where the court found there was no notice of national origin harassment because the plaintiffs did not allege that they ever complained about any specific harassment based upon national origin, or that the city otherwise had knowledge of the alleged harasser's actions. Now, Valentine also claims for the first time in her reply brief that the harassment was so obvious the city should be charged with constructive knowledge of it. Again, not an argument ever previously made in this case. But even if the argument is not waived, she cites to no evidence in either her opening brief or reply brief that others knew about the conduct or comments directed at her, with the exception of the cookie incident, which not only appears in front of coworkers, but to which we immediately respond. Instead, she does point to conduct regarding Elizabeth Farrell, for which Tominello is under investigation, and comments directed at Colleen Julian. Just for the record, I'd like to clarify that the allegation is not that Tominello rubbed deer testicles in Farrell's face. It's that he waved them. Not a great distinction, but my point is that counsel has exaggerated the facts in this case, bringing up things like patronage, no evidence of patronage here, no evidence that Sinise and Mr. Tominello are these great friends and that he's transferring Tominello because he wants to protect him, not in the record. In any event...
So there's no record evidence of the representation of social contact between the two?
There's some evidence that Mr. Sinise knows Mr. Tominello's father and that they used to belong to the Italian-American Club, but Mr. Sinise, I believe, had left the Italian-American Club. And Valentine hasn't pointed to any case law that holds that because a person is under investigation for harassing one person, he should be assumed to be harassing others. And especially in this case, there's no evidence that the conduct directed toward Ms. Valentine was open and obvious. As for the issue of whether Mike DeTusa was a supervisor whose knowledge of Tominello's harassment could be imputed to the city for purposes of Title VII, our point is like the one made by this court in cases such as Parkins, Rhodes, and Habrowski, that not everyone with the title supervisor is empowered so that his actions, and in this case particularly his knowledge, can be imputed to the employer leading to Title VII liability. And counsel just now made the argument that in our policy we say he can complain, she's allowed to complain to a supervisor. But that, again, is not an argument ever made to this court in his briefs or below, that she was entitled just to go to somebody because their name was a supervisor. Repeatedly throughout their briefs, they talk about that the issue is job duties and title. And even on page 19 of their opening brief, right, and I quote, "What titles the city gives its employees is not plaintiff's concern." It's our position that for someone to be a supervisor whose knowledge of harassment can bind the city under Title VII, and that's what this is about, binding us under Title VII, that the person has to have some authority over the terms and conditions of the plaintiff's employment. In other words, have some authority to hire, fire, promote, demote.
But isn't there a big difference between reporting co-worker sexual harassment and supervisor sexual harassment? I mean, there's a distinction to be drawn here, don't you think?
Right, but in this case, the claim is we didn't tell him who a supervisor was and who she should go to, and that she wasn't really relying on our policy for that reason. So she cites to Parkins and says, under Parkins, I didn't know who to go to, so I can go to somebody who it was reasonable for me to think I should go to. And Parkins...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Parkins is very specifically on point with this, because in Parkins, there was a sexual harassment policy in place, and the employee didn't really know about it. And in this case, I'd also point out that she's got her expert testimony quoted in her on page 12, describing how inadequate and unpublicized our policy is. And she says, well, so I didn't know who to go to, so I went to the dispatcher, and I thought the dispatcher was my supervisor. And this court says, well, let's look at the dispatcher's authority, and specifically looks at that under the hire, fire, promote, demote, and discipline test, and found he was not a supervisor to whom Parkins should have reported harassment, precisely because he had none of that authority.
Yeah, but what about Loughman, where we stated that whether an employee is a supervisor for purposes of reporting sexual harassment is really a question for the jury, and there's certainly sufficient evidence here based on what he did and the position, you know, in terms of supervising the other employees and that kind of thing. Why shouldn't that go to the jury?
Because even in Loughman, when it's interesting, when you read Loughman, the person to whom Loughman complained is the restaurant manager, a guy named Solis, and he did have the authority of a supervisor, as that term is used under Title VII, because when you look at the facts of that case, in the facts section it says that after the waitress goes to him and reports the first incident of harassment, the supervisor warns one of the harassers that, quote, he would be fired if he touched Loughman again. This court also had concluded in that case that Loughman reported harassment to her supervisor and says that while Malnally's policy allowed the employees to report incidents to upper management, a reasonable jury could find that Loughman took adequate steps by reporting the incident to Solis, one of her supervisors, the guy who could fire people. There's no authority in this case regarding firing or discipline. And
Detusa could transfer, though, couldn't he?
No, Detusa could not.
He couldn't do that.
No, the facts in this case are that Ms. Valentine says Detusa could transfer. Mr. Detusa and Mr. Sinise say he couldn't transfer. And the fact of the matter is, even if he could, there's no indication in this case that transferring someone is some kind of exercise of any meaningful authority, because the record shows that it's Mr. Sinise who's actually giving out the authorities. She's a truck driver. She's transferred to her means she's just going to go to another lot, pick up her assignment from the same guy giving out the assignments, and drive her truck to someplace in the city. So there's no change. That's just not...
Well, lot location vis-a-vis residence could, in a city of this size, could impact conditions of employment, I would think.
But, again, Parkins is a case, in other cases... like Rhodes, deal with that kind of authority, that just because you have some minimal authority, that's not necessarily enough to make you a supervisor under Title VII. And just to point out that in Parkins, and in other cases, but let's stick with Parkins for the moment, that the key test is whether the person exercises discretion or decision-making authority, and because the dispatcher in Parkins exercised no disciplinary authority and was not responsible for addressing disciplinary problems, he wasn't a supervisor to whom somebody could go and complain about sexual harassment. In her brief, Valentine makes much of her claim that when she complained to Detusa, he told her he would take care of it, and for this reason, the court should conclude that he was a supervisor. What he really says, though, is he'll take care of it. He would talk to Tominello. That's on actually page 67 of her brief, so that's the full quote. Again, he's not saying you're going to talk to somebody. It's not saying you're assuming authority to do anything other than talk to somebody.
So the record wouldn't reflect at this point Detusa could transfer Tominello to another yard.
No, it would not. I mean, not on the facts. It reflects her hearsay testimony.
No, I appreciate that the position of the plaintiff.
Valentine's argument that the Parkins line of cases defining who is a supervisor is inapplicable for purposes of imputing knowledge of wrongdoing, it's our position would result in this kind of chaotic application of Title VII. This court has already in Parkins addressed the fact that you do have to look at supervisory authority to decide if someone is the appropriate person to go to.
So you're saying that the supervision by Detusa of the 40 drivers on the site, resolving workplace disputes, reporting problems to superiors, in his parking spot, which was labeled lot supervisor, that's just evidence we should ignore?
Some of that is not supported by the record, particularly that comment that he managed 40 to 50 truck drivers. Our point is that under Title VII, to bind the city, you need to look at the person's authority.
So what's
to
your
hire
position
fire.
On whether he managed? You're saying he didn't manage 40. He didn't,
absolutely.
Tell them what their
he
job,
did not.
Where they were to go or the routing they were supposed to take. He didn't do that. Who did that?
Joe Sinise. Valentine asserts in her reply brief that her complaints about Tominella resulted in retaliation and hostility from coworkers. There's no dispute that the sexual harassment stopped after she complained about Tominella to Sinise, and she's not properly raised any claims of retaliation, having failed to brief them in her opening brief. I just want to briefly address the 1983 issues and just say that counsel has mentioned claimed that there are other incidents of harassment in the Department of Transportation and the Water Department. There is nothing in the record about other incidents of harassment involving anybody other than Mr. Tominello. And for that reason, there's just no claim here that the city has a policy of harassment. As for the claims against Mr. Sinise and Mr. D'Souza, they're not policymakers, and they... And Mr. D'Souza's response, even if it was ineffective, doesn't show intent to harass. Mr. Sinise should be lauded. Valentine comes to him, complains. The next day, a sexual harassment investigation is launched. So there's no 1983 violation in that case. Unless there's other questions, for all the reasons we set forth here today and in our briefs,
thank you.
We ask for affirmance. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Masters. Mr. Angelini?
I think I used up half my time walking to the podium. I represent the Ted Stein proclaimed lowlife serial sexual harasser, John Tominello. I would like to respond to 100 of the facts that Ted put out before your honors as to the sexual harassment that my client allegedly made against his client. Unfortunately, he never addressed my client in his brief. There was no argument in his brief that the granting a motion for summary judgment against my client was improper. I'm not so sure that there's anything that I really have to respond to. I do know this: whenever Mr. Stein talks, these allegations of sexual harassment, whether it's at the motion for summary judgment hearing, the motion for rehearing, or the motions for before your honor, these allegations get more grandiose and grandiose as he goes along. There's things that I heard from Mr. Stein today for the first time that my client did. So I would ask that your honors, when you go back, look at the record, look at the facts, look at what was brought out in the summary judgment, the arguments and the facts that were brought out at that time. And really, against my client, there is nothing that was addressed in their brief. So I really have, other than that, I have no other response.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Angelini. Mr. Stein.
D'Souza knew about Tominello's transfer of his sexual harassment investigation. He knew it because Tominello told him. He knew it because he and Sinise talked about it. So when, even if what Mr. Master says concerning the statements that my client allegedly made about to Mr. D'Souza about harassment did not include reference to sexual harassment, did not use the word sexual harassment, D'Souza knew about what Tominello did at 39th Street and what he was under investigation for. But the fact of the matter...
So then you concede that in the conversation she had with the direct supervisor, D'Souza, that she never said that she was sexually harassed or that these comments were of a sexual nature?
No, I don't concede that.
The language as counsel is put forth, and obviously we have to, you know, comb through the record even more, is that, you know, even from her own words, she says that he harassed her and he was a problem, but didn't say anything about the sexual nature of it. Isn't that problematic?
No. Yes, it would be if it was true, but it's not true because Ms. Valentine, in her testimony, said... gave a list of items of what she complained, what Tominello did to her, said to her, and was asked whether or not she complained about this conduct to Mr. D'Souza, and she said yes. Now, whether or not, in my opinion, the inference is that she incorporated those specific allegations, there is plenty of evidence in the record that my client complained to Mr. D'Souza about the conduct of Tominella, which included the inappropriate grabbing his crotch, talking about getting your pipes cleaned in Chinatown, talking about going out on dates, talking about dinner, leaving your fiance.
And so those things that you've outlined, those were all items that she outlined in her deposition prior to making the statement in her deposition that she complained about this and this was harassment.
That
I'm
is,
just trying to get what the record is.
I can't tell you as I stand here whether or not she said, I don't believe she said, he is sexually harassing me. I think that that language is not there. I don't even think that she, that was in her vocabulary either. Mm-hmm. But the Tominella, D'Souza knew what she was saying about Tominella's behavior.
Mr. Stein, on the question of the supervisor issue, what would you say, as the record presently exists, are the strongest indications why this should go to the jury on that? What would you point to? I know you've done some of this in the brief, but I just wanted you to, for us today, tell us the two or three things that you believe are jury questions on the supervisor issue.
Okay. First, I'd like to say I think the court should take a look at Young versus Bayer, where Judge Posner talks about a company putting layers in between to protect itself. Having said that, D'Souza didn't all of a sudden anoint himself lot supervisor. He was made lot supervisor. He was in charge of these guys. And they were seasonal. In the summertime and spring, there were more than in the wintertime.
Yeah, but would he determine that quotient? I mean, this suggestion that he's more of a clerical
right.
administrator as opposed to a manager, so to speak, issuing tickets for routing as opposed to something else. I guess I want to focus on for just a second what is what you would point to move him, if he is to be moved, from this dispatcher who somebody's got to just hand out the routing to somebody who has power beyond that.
Well, he's more than a dispatcher in that sense of the word. He may not have. I don't think that he was the one who made the decision of what streets to pave. That came from somewhere else. Probably Sinise didn't make that decision either.
Or the number of people at the lot, maybe.
I'm sorry?
Or maybe the number of drivers at a particular lot.
Well, I think what he would do is he would make sure that those places that had to be paved were covered. I think he would make sure that the trucks were in good repair, that he would assign people to trucks, to specific trucks, and make specific assignments as to who was going to do what on a particular day, especially if somebody was not there, who was absent.
Has there been any deposition evidence to point to that?
I think so. I think that in the list of things that D'Souza did, he was her supervisor. He was responsible for 45 to 50 drivers. He parked in the supervisor's lot. He made the appointment of an E-man. He solved workplace issues. He reported problems to his supervisor or to his superior. He kept everyone intact and working. He if the drivers had problems, they'd come to him. And on and on and on throughout his deposition. He referred to himself as a supervisor. During the SHO investigation, when there was no reason to particularly fabricate who was a supervisor or not, when this defense wasn't even in existence, everybody who was asked as who your supervisor was said D'Souza.
All right,
I see the red light is on. I thank you very much. I asked the court to reverse the district court. By the way, even Judge Duryagian found Tominella's behavior to be deplorable, to use that word, to reverse the case, reinstate, and even if the court does not reverse the federal claims, to send the state law claims, the supplemental claims that Tominella is charged in and other defendants are charged in, back to the district court. Discovery is full. There's no reason to send it to state court, and there's a statute of limitations problem. And Rule 36 should apply. Thank you.
All right. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And